along to the Property Academy podcast. I'm your host, Ed McKnight.
And I'm Andrew Nicholl.
And today on the show, we are joined by Matthew Harris from Lighthouse Financial and Momentum Property. He is a property accountant and an ex-IRD investigator. And in today's show, we are going to talk about those common misconceptions Kiwi property investors have around property tax. Now, Matt, talk to us. When you get property investors coming into your office here, what are some of those common misconceptions that they have around property tax in particular?
Yeah, thanks, Ed. Thanks, Andrew. Look, I usually start when a new client comes into my office, sit them down, and what I'm primarily interested in is their intention. So whether they're going to be a buy and hold investor or whether they're going to be a trader. Once we've established that, then I would usually start by explaining how our intention-based regime works in New Zealand. And look, it's pretty simple at its core. Your intention when you purchase the property will dictate how it's taxed. So everything kind of follows from that. Some things that people don't often understand is that the bright line rules, for example, are just a supplement to that intention-based test, and that someone's status as a buy and hold investor or a dealer, a developer or trader in land can change over time, and that can lead to other issues such as tainting.
So walk us through those differences based on that intention between the buy and hold and the traders. What are those differences for new listeners to the show?
Yeah, so the intention-based regime's been around quite a while now, and prior to the Brightline rules in October 2015, it was pretty easy, but pretty difficult as well. If you buy a property with the intention of holding it for the long term, then you won't pay tax on any eventual gain. So prior to October 2015, the long term wasn't very well defined. So in Land Revenue, for example, when I was working there, we used to look at the patterns of traders, whether they bought and sold properties in quick succession, and try and establish that and prove that actually they should be paying tax.
And so when you are proving that, so the IRD has an all-encompassing reach when it comes to being able to look at documents. What kind of things would you do?
Yeah, they had pretty wide powers under Section 17 of the Tax Administration Act. Most commonly, we'd go to the bank managers.
Yeah.
And to the real estate agents, and it was pretty easy most of the time. And out on the other side, as a property investor myself, when I go to the bank to ask for money, you know, they want to know what it's for. Mm. And the way that a bank documents and lends on a buy and hold is vastly different to how they will document and lend on a trade.
What are those differences, just for those of us who are curious?
Yeah, it comes down to cost and term. So with a buy and hold investment, the banks are usually quite willing to lend at a low rate over a long term, and they will make their money on, obviously, the spread over that time.
30-year loan term.
Yep, 25, 30, depending. And
sorry, I forget you're much older than me.
1 year, maybe. And if you're a trader, then quite often, especially nowadays, main banks don't seem particularly interested in lending to traders. So you're usually playing in the second tier space, Resimac, Bluestone, Liberty. Actually, all good lenders, very good rates, but the term's a lot shorter. You'll pay establishment fees, lending fees, and the interest rate will usually be at least a couple percent higher, sometimes more.
And actually, I was catching up with a friend of mine yesterday who has done quite a lot of development in Auckland, and actually he had a development which was meant to be a buy and hold, and they ended up deciding actually they were going to sell it. And he said that the IRD rang every contractor he dealt with and asked them what the intention was. Do you know what the intention was for that? And ask them whether or not they were going to buy and hold or going to sell it. So they go to all extremes to collect their money, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, that's a great point about the intention-based regime. People's intentions can and do change. So the most common intention change we get in our office is a buy and hold investor who's come in, they've bought the property, they've given it a quick reno to tidy it up, add some value, and they were going to have every intention to hold it for 5+ years to get outside the Brightline rule. And the neighbours come along and said, hey, I really like this property, I want my mother-in-law to live here, I'll pay you $50,000 above market value. It's too good a deal to pass up, so they'll change their intention. In that case, a lot of people, you know, come racing into my office, they're like, oh, you know, how much tax do I have to pay? What's the GST bill going to be? Commonly, as long as there hasn't been a pattern of previous intention changes, you will trigger the Brightline rule. That's the buying and selling within 5 years. It was actually 2 years when it came in originally, and from March 2018 onwards, it's been 5 years. So what happens under the Brightline rules is they effectively, because we do not have a capital gains tax, they treat it like a revenue gain. So you're allowed to deduct the cost base, any costs in renovating that property, and also real estate fees, etc., and the net gain will be taxed.
And in that instance, just moving on to tainting, would that cause the rest of the portfolio that that investor had to be tainted and then to be treated with a different intention?
Not generally. So tainting is something that is widely misunderstood. And there's two types of tainting, which makes it a little more confusing. So there's people who are dealers, developers or traders in land or associated to them, which is generally 2 degrees of blood relationship, common trustees, company shareholders, etc. It's the blood relationship ones that get people. And the other is builders, and they taint in different ways. So a dealer, a developer and trader in land will taint a buy and hold property if they buy it at the same time that they're actively trading in land or properties. So what that means is any buy and hold properties that they purchase prior to becoming a dealer and a trader in land won't be tainted, and anything after they completely cease that activity will not be tainted. So the common misconception I see is people believing that they will be tainted forever just by doing one trade.
So if you're using both strategies of buy and hold and you're doing development or trades and you're going to be tainted, what would you do there from a structure perspective?
Yeah, so there's no, the associated party rules were rewritten to stop people from structuring out of tainting. So yes, there's not a hell of a lot that can be done.
Yes.
So really what you actually, the advice would be, hey, property investment's a long-term game. You might have some properties that aren't tainted. So once they're outside 5 years, and you need to sell something, sell one of those. Mm. Otherwise, you just know that 10 years is the goalpost, and that will let the incremental gain over time that property investment has occur. So the building one's an interesting one. The way builders taint is that they do not taint the property until they do a substantial development of it or a renovation. So you could hold a property as a builder for 11 years, and then if you do a reno and sell it and it's deemed substantial enough, then it would be tainted.
So could cosmetic, so say you had just an old house, an old villa that you weren't going to actually do any development of it other than just rip up the carpets and put in some new curtains and all that kind of thing, would that be considered significant?
I think that'd probably be okay.
Yeah.
They look at the scale, but there is no hard and fast rule.
Yeah. So it's just one that you've got to tread with
and
caution.
To be honest, I don't see that type of tainting as much. Most builders, and they have to be in a building business too, not just employed as one, for example. Most builders actively out there, they're either flipping, you know, on the side, or they are buying holds and just holding on to them, and I don't see much in between. Yeah, so tainting is something that is quite misunderstood. So to answer your question, Ed, no, that wouldn't taint.
And also, just before we move on to talk about ring fencing as well, Matt, we talked about just before that if an investor is going through a second-tier lender, that might be, in the IRD's eyes, a bit of a trigger to say, well, perhaps they're doing some trading, perhaps they're doing some development. If a normal buy-and-hold investor is going through a second-tier lender because that's what they need to do in order to be able to get the finance, does that put them at any risk of having the IRD pick up the phone and give them a call?
No, I don't think so. And the key difference actually that Inlay Revenue would look for people who have been open about it, is a buy and hold investor would be only subject to income tax, and that's because GST is exempt on residential rentals. Yeah. Primarily the government doesn't want to levy GST on rents, which makes sense. So if you're a trader, you will register for GST if you're doing it right, and you'll claim GST. So that's the primary indicator. Mm-hmm. So it's not the second tier lending, and we do have lots of buy and hold clients who use second tiers because
they need to.
Yeah, because they need to. They're a little bit more relaxed on equity and servicing.
And lastly, let's talk about ring fencing and some of the misconceptions there. Obviously, this came in, I think it was late last year. Talk to us about this. What are investors still thinking about it?
Yeah, I think ultimately my point of view on ring fencing is actually a good thing. We're seeing over the last few years the rise of the professional investor, and that's someone who, you know, doesn't put a suit and tie on when they go out and buy property. It's someone who thinks about the numbers, talks to people like you guys, listens to this podcast, and that they're armed with a bit of information. So number one rule in any business, and property is no different, is try not to make a loss.
Great role.
Makes a lot of sense. And so when depreciation was removed from buildings a few years back now, most non-cash expenses are gone. You get chattels still.
Yeah.
But what that really means is that $1 of loss is actually an economic dollar of loss.
Yes.
And the maximum tax refund you used to be able to get on that was 33 cents. Maximum tax you pay on a dollar of profit is 33 cents. So pretty easy to figure out you're better off one way than the other. Investors don't see it like that. What they see is that refund that previously was topping up, you know, part of the cost of owning an investment property disappearing. So the first thing I do when people come into my office and start having a little complaint about the ring fencing is I sit down and have a bit of a reality check. Have you raised your rents?
Yeah.
What's your interest rate like? A simple
Especially now with rates coming down so low, it's very easy to restructure things to a profitable state, no matter where you've bought.
Yeah, absolutely. And we often take people that are on 4.5%. We drop it to 2.5% at the moment and suddenly it's positive.
Yeah.
So the misconception about ring fencing is that their loss is gone. It is not. It's available. It just simply cannot offset because it's ring fenced. So it can only offset other types of property income.
So then if an investor were to buy something that is highly positively geared, they can use those losses to offset that, right?
Correct. Yep, as long as they're structured correctly. And also Brightline gains can be offset against losses, which is quite useful.
Yeah.
So they're a deferred tax asset. They carry forward until you can use them. One of the little issues with the rules is that there is a loss extinguishing part to them. What that means is if you extinguish your total portfolio holdings and you have a loss remaining, that will also be extinguished with the sale of the last property. And I think that was designed to stop people carrying historic losses, which is a bit of a problem for Inland Revenue.
Yes.
We used to have an inside joke at Inland Revenue. We call them approved tax losses. That's when Inland Revenue's issued the computer letter with your loss.
Tough crowd at IRD, isn't it?
Yeah, we're a funny bunch.
Fantastic. Let's wrap it up there. But please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast. It really does help us get the message out to more people. And hey, if you want to learn more about property with Andrew and I, why not come along to our live podcast events? Now, remember, we have shifted the dates back by about 5 weeks so that they are in mid-October. I think it's the 20th, 21st, and 22nd. Now, I'm going to drop a link to this in the show notes. So tap or swipe over the cover up. There'll be a link in there. Or just go to opspartners.co.nz/pod-event. Thanks for listening to the Property Academy podcast. I'm your host, Ed McKnight.
And I'm Andrew Nicholl.
And we're going to be back again tomorrow with even more daily strategies, tactics, and insights to help you get the most out of the New Zealand property market. Until next time.